Welcome back to Driving Progress with Audi and me, Sonia Lennon. Join me throughout the series as I speak to a number of Audi brand ambassadors and special guests about living their passions, personal beliefs, the importance of progress, and their attitudes towards the future. We welcome you to experience progress with Audi. Our guest today is Dr. Eeske Britton, a champion surfer, scientist, social activist, artist, filmmaker, and author. Eeske, you're a lot of things. And I want to start this conversation by saying how just so excited to talk to you today. I'm going to give you four touch points where I think we intersect very, very strongly. I was born in Donegal. I'm the mother of twins. I'm a gender equality activist, and I call the sea my medicine. So I know we're going to have a ton of things to talk about today. You're so welcome to the podcast.
Oh my goodness, Sonia, that's amazing. I can't believe how many touch points we have. We're like, yeah, sisters from another mother. Sea sisters.
Sea sisters. I like that a lot. So, you know, you are a world leader in your field, but there may be people in the listenership who don't know about the work that you do. And it is extraordinary. But I would really like to start at the beginning because there is a sense of the fairy tale and that magic and the magical relationship that you have with the sea started from a very young age. You might just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it certainly did. And there is a kind of touch of the mythology to it, even with, I suppose, having a name like Eeske. So I was born into the surfing way of life in Donegal. And born to surfing parents who named me after their favorite wave on the west coast of Ireland. And Eeske also comes from the Irish for fish, Eesk. And I kind of always then had an affinity with the mythology around the Salmon of Knowledge or Bradon Fasa, because at Eeske, the place in County Sligo, an important salmon river comes out and creates this wave. And so there's just so many lovely synergies there and connections with that kind of oceanic world. And so very, very, from a very early age, the ocean has completely shaped and informed who I am, my sense of identity, and where I feel most at home.
And I think, you know, looking at your story and the importance of family and community and that socialization that is very much part of your world, how much of a link does the sea play in that?
It's definitely what kind of brings us all together as a family. And we very much from an early age would have looked at, I suppose, lived our lives based on swell patterns and tides and all those kinds of natural cycles, which kind of at the time seemed just normal. By that, I mean, even to get to, you know, the shortcut to get to school is across the beach at Rasnaula. And so we'd learn about the tides, whether it was high or low, and if we could get to school in time or not. And then family trips were always based on these road trips, looking for waves and camping out by surf breaks and spending time in rock pools exploring before I would have followed my dad into the surf. And so it just opened up this whole other world for myself and my sister from an early age. And just, I think, to have that kind of connection with something outside of ourselves, like the ocean, that's so powerful. And then in such a positive way, and having it on our doorstep growing up served us in so many ways.
And, you know, the podcast is called Driving Progress. And I'm always fascinated by the idea that sometimes progress is about looking backwards and reconnecting with the truest sense of ourselves, if you like. And you spoke about, you know, understanding the tides and the rhythm of the ocean in terms of how you live your daily life. Do you, and we'll come to your greater campaigning work in a little while, but do you see that potential to connect to the cycles of the earth, the natural cycles of the earth, as part of a solution?
Yeah, really great question. And I've been thinking about this when it comes to progress as well. The tendency to think of progress as this sort of continual, endless growth. How do we do more, achieve more? And actually, if you look then to the rest of the living world and to nature, it's cyclical, not linear. And I think progress has a lot to do with that, if we could honor those cycles more. So by that, I mean, you know, the rest as well as the action, the ebb as much as the flow, as it were. And I think, you know, that resonates, I suppose, with a lot of athletes in particular, of that the need for that downtime and recovery. But increasingly how we live our lives, that essential part of progress is missing. And in nature, it's so important, like the decomposition and the decay is as important for what's to come next when we have new growth in the spring. And in my experience and observations too, it's often in that downtime, in that kind of ebb state, I kind of like to think of it, that really defines those then peak performance moments, or how we're able to show up in the face of challenge. Or so it's always about, for me, what's happening in those kind of spaces in between. And often then with surfing, you often just see the wave that's ridden. But you don't actually, there's so much that has gone into that moment of connection and being able to ride the wave before that. So I think of these spaces between the waves, of what's happening there. It's really interesting.
And I think you occupy a very interesting space as an eminent academic who is so connected with that mythology and magic of water and our oceans. I just love that the two can sort of reside together so comfortably. You might tell us a little bit about where your career began. So obviously the water is flowing through you. And one of the favorite lines that I've heard you say is that water knows no gender. I love that idea that it's a sort of a genderless zone. But talk to us a little bit about, you know, where your studies started, obviously informed by your childhood.
Yeah, gosh, it's fascinating to look at. And my relationship with the ocean has been constant, and the sea and surfing. But I also realize, looking back, it's been continually evolving and changing as I grow, I suppose, as well. And what I learn from it. And I think through surfing, that's really what fueled my curiosity in particular, because you're immersed in this other world that's unfamiliar to us as humans mostly. And we transition from this sort of grounded, familiar world into a really, you know, ever-changing, fluid, dynamic space that we can never fully understand or control, really, the ocean. And it's so there's so much to be learned from that as well.
And actually, it's such a key point, because as an elite athlete, which you were for many, many years, I suppose part of the job of the team around an elite athlete is to control as much as possible. And you're in this realm where so much of it is beyond you.
Yeah, it's unlike kind of anything else I've experienced, you know. And if you look at it, yeah, in the sporting context, it kind of goes against the grain in many reasons. There's so many uncontrollables. But a lot of, I think those, for my, when I look at my surfing career, my sort of peak performance moments are always those ones where I'm able to really let go of expectation and to really feel that sense of I'm in active participation with the ocean. So that kind of connection and relationship, but also to be really, I suppose, present in my body rather than caught up in the performance or the outcomes or expectations, which it can be, when that happens, it's so incredibly freeing, especially I think for women in particular. To just be free of all that and the embodied kind of experience when you're on a wave in particular. And then when it comes to shaping, I suppose, going back to my career and decision and to go into academia and science, and how did that all come about from a, you know, professional surfing career? I've just always been fascinated with our relationship with the ocean, with nature, and its effect on me. And I guess that combined with my curiosity, then wanting to better understand how is that experience for other people? What is it about water that makes us feel the way it does? Why am I drawn to it in order to feel a certain way? So also, you know, the reason why I surf is because of how it makes me feel. And it's that, you know, that mood enhancing sense of freedom, of connection. And I was curious to better understand that. And then as a surfer, you're really immersed in an environment. It is changing, but it's also changing in ways that I suppose we're impacting it around negatively by our behaviors and actions. And you're really in, when you're surfing, you're really in the front lines of that change, of witnessing the deterioration or decline or pollution of something that you really love. And so it just, it becomes this responsibility then to want to care for it, to better understand how to protect it. And so all of that led me then down the path of initially environmental science.
And what I find kind of extraordinary is that you could have, you know, it is such a meditative thing to be in that wonderful space, to commune with the ocean. For so many people, that's enough to do it for themselves. But you took what you knew, you married it with your deepened understanding through research, and you reached out. I mean, I think that's what's one of the most impressive things about you. You know, never mind the world global accolades for your elite sport. You have an extreme generosity with your knowledge and your abilities. Tell us a little bit about some of the projects that you've been involved in.
Yeah, it's interesting, the unexpected paths something like surfing can take you on. The biggest kind of turning point for me would have been a trip I made, first made actually in 2010 to Iran. So not a typical surf destination by any stretch of the imagination.
Iski, I have to ask, how did that start? What was the bouncing off point for that trip?
I guess it was at that stage, maybe in my surfing career too, where I was perhaps, I knew I'd been in the contest circuit for quite a while, and I felt a little bit stuck in a bubble. I had actually just started my studies as well. And I guess I was curious and hungry to have experiences of, I suppose, deeper experiences connecting with a place and a people when I traveled, rather than just doing the contest circuit and kind of being actually quite removed from a lot of those kinds of interactions. And then with surfing having grown so rapidly all around the world, it was just that kind of naive, almost adventure-seeking mentality of finding somewhere that hadn't really been surfed before. Which now looking back is, yeah, but at least it lent itself to a beginner's mindset when we showed up in Iran. And it had initially been planned by, I guess, a friend of a friend who worked for a travel guide and also is a surf photographer. And so he kind of initially proposed Iran. But then when it ended up, we had a whole team of people who were supposed to go. But in the end, it was only myself and French filmmaker Marion Poiseau who made the trip. Everyone else fell by the wayside for various reasons. And I think it was also maybe a lot of it was fear-based, going to somewhere like that and not knowing what we might experience, if we'd even be able to surf. And so initially we didn't have any support at all. Everyone thought we were crazy. But a whole other world opened up in such unexpected ways. It was really there through the experiences of meeting other Iranian sportswomen, especially, completely opened my eyes to what surfing could be and the potential of the ocean to actually create connection across all these so-called divides in society, or be they gender or class or whatever. And then the inherent power of surfing when it's shared in that way to create this sense of connection through playfulness, when you take out actually the competitive or performance part. And just seeing that kind of transformation happening in such an unlikely corner of the world, of opening up the ocean for to have those kinds of experiences that I had from when I was a child growing up in Rosnallen, Donegal. And here it was happening in like the remotest part of Iran, in Balochistan.
You know, reading about that experience, and some of the women that you worked with would have been familiar with surfing, but some of them absolutely weren't.
No one had surfed before in this region of Iran anyways. And everyone, yeah, we'd worked. It's the first time they'd seen surfing. We went back. This is, so the timeline is actually over the last decade. It's been, we're seeing the evolution and growth of the sport of surfing in Iran now. But the origin story remains that it was initiated by women. So those first sportswomen that I met and took surfing in those early days.
So it was really initiated by you. You're too humble to say it, but that's extraordinary. You opened it up to a community, and you must feel very gratified by the sense of freedom that you've been able to imbue with them.
It was really unexpected. I suppose I learned a lot from them about the kind of the strength that comes from vulnerability, you know, of just that and the awareness that the ocean and those experiences aren't equally accessible to all. And yet when they are, there's that real just commonality of the experience of just how much joy it can instill, how transformative it can be, how empowering for women in particular, especially connecting with their bodies and restoring confidence in something like the power of the ocean. I've seen how healing that can be. So it was a real eye opener for me. And fast forward now, you know, a decade later, one of the women I first taught to surf is actually representing her country in the World Surfing Games in El Salvador. So we couldn't have imagined any of this. It happened very organically. And then we kind of met various challenges along the way that we've been meeting in terms of even with the design of surfwear, making that more, offering more options for the diversity of women and girls who surf now.
And while this is happening over the last decade, you're also pursuing your academic career. So give us a little timeline of that.
Yeah, it's kind of, I think maybe the best way to look at the timeline is to look at it, say, through the lens of my relationship with surfing and how the motivation to surf and what it offers me, how that's been changing. And I suppose in my childhood, it really offered that place of that freedom and play and autonomy to be able to experience safely, that kind of sense of independence as you're growing into your own sense of self as a little person. and the inherent playfulness that comes from surfing. And then moving into, I suppose, my teenage years, early 20s, that kind of competitive drive, the ability to, I suppose, use surfing as this vehicle to travel and meet new people, experience new places through competitions, and to have that kind of focus. And then I guess then in my 20s, it's that real, archetypally speaking, that phase and stage of really self-discovery, of exploration, and the importance of being able to, experiment and take risks and try new things, but without any real agenda or without any need to have it all figured out. So I've learned that through surfing, which I think is really important as well, because any decision I've ever made, I always felt totally unprepared and had no idea of how it was going to go until I'd already initiated it. And then sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I also, it was real boundary pushing time. I suppose I was drawn then to go to the edge of everything. So physically and mentally with big wave surfing, of really kind of confronting and meeting my fears through that and where my limits might lie with surfing bigger and bigger waves and physically and mentally preparing for that. And alongside that, then I also kind of had fully immersed myself in academia and had started a PhD studies in Ulster University. So looking back now, I think I just needed to go to the edge there, those extremes, and really stretch myself. And then now in my 30s, it's changed again completely. And it's very much more about that kind of, I suppose, at a personal level, about how it fulfills my need for time to just connect with my body, time to just feel that kind of, I suppose it gives me a lot of that pleasure, those feel-good hormones that I need when I need rebalancing. And then also my work then through helping others connect with it by recognizing just how restorative it can be. So a lot of work I do now is around ocean therapy and what's called blue health. So, and that's where my surfing and my academic training kind of really align and come together now in ways I didn't see before. So I use my training as a marine social scientist to help programs like surf therapy programs like Liquid Therapy, based in Donegal here, who are creating these programs primarily for young people to be able to access who maybe otherwise wouldn't be able to access the sea or surfing, to tap into some of that healing potential, especially the psychological restorativeness. And then a lot of my research is looking at like evidencing why water is so psychologically restorative for us and what it can do for our well-being.
And in terms of blue health as a global movement, where are we at in that?
We are at the very early stages in many ways. I mean, it's a lot of it kind of has grown dramatically since Wallace J. Nichols published his book called Blue Mind, looking at that, the effect of water, of being in on or near water on our well-being, essentially. And then since then, there's been a lot of research that I suppose around nature connection, but then looking at what is it in particular about water? Why do we seem drawn to it as humans? And what does it offer us that maybe is perhaps different to being in the woods or those kinds of things? And it's sort of, it seems to be growing alongside the urgency as well as our water bodies and these water environments are deteriorating and declining in terms of their health and our own mental health then is in crisis too. And so we're really kind of supposed as a society seeking ways to restore some of those lost connections. I think we intuitively, innately know that we're part of nature and that when we go to it and immerse ourselves in it, it can heal us. And we saw that evidently throughout the pandemic. And it's been one of the best kind of unexpected perhaps outcomes and side effects is so many more people going to the sea to swim or to dip or to bathe or surf.
And there's so much in what you're giving me in terms of answers. It's like there's so many strands to pick at. I feel like I'm reaching in all direction. You know, offering this therapy to particularly young people who don't normally have access to it. What are the demographic of those kids, and where's the pipeline coming from?
Yeah, there are a lot of young kids who come from families who are really, I suppose, stretched to their limit and unable to access mental health services, especially for young people. They're a real diverse spectrum. So one program we work with is called A Drop in the Ocean. And a lot of the young people there would have autism, but it runs the gamut from a lot of, you know, various physical disabilities to mental health issues. Across the whole spectrum, really. But it tends to be, it's with families who I can't access any support anywhere else. And then this is their one kind of moment of respite. And they travel from all over. So we're mostly based in Donegal, and their programs are beginning to expand now through trainings in other locations, which is fantastic. But, you know, mums in particular will drive their kids, you know, 2 hours or more just to have this time in the water for an hour or two, because they know how beneficial it will be then.
And what are you seeing as the benefits then? And I'm asking this question knowing what I've seen the benefits of being so much more connected with the water. You know, are you seeing kids light up before your very eyes? Are mothers coming back and fathers coming back and saying the difference that it's made?
There's so many powerful testimonies, and there's a lot of research now being initiated kind of worldwide in this area, but we're just really scratching the surface. But yes, definitely, there's, especially with young people, again and again, it's just that sense of, there's many things that they enhance kind of confidence, because you're entering the ocean and it's challenging and it's not an environment that we can fully control, and you have to take risks. And that's actually so important for young people to do that in a space that's really enabling. And so then they feel, and once they move through their own fears, you see this transformation happening and their confidence blossoming. And then it's just that connection with the ocean itself, of being outside in nature in this really tactile sensory environment. So the multi-sensory qualities of the waves and the surf and the whole environment can be very calming, grounding and restorative in and of itself. And then when all of that happens, this kind of, I suppose you're almost, what's happening is you're actually co-regulating your nervous system almost with the energy of the ocean. And that's what happens. It does down regulate the whole system. We feel a greater sense of calm, reduces stress and anxiety. And once that happens, then you see this openness and social engagement and connection happening that spills over into their peer groups with their families at school. Parents will often say how they had these really deep conversations and sharing with their children, bonding with them on the drive home then after their surf in a way they never would have maybe shared before. So little things like that even.
Little things that are big things. And I'm sure we'll put it in the show notes, but if anybody wants to get involved in that program, how do they find it?
Yeah, so Liquid Therapy, they're based in Donegal. Liquid Therapy .ie, I think you'll find them. But we're also part of an EU kind of research consortium and group of other organizations across Europe doing this work called Inclusi. So developing a methodology to help create, I suppose, more inclusive ocean-based experiences for everyone. In this case, looking at people with various physical disabilities. So looking to remove as many barriers as possible to access those benefits of being able to get in the sea. And in September, we have the Blue Surf Fest, which will really showcase and bring together all these elements and showcase what happens in practice and also then the research around the benefits as well.
Gorgeous. It sounds like the sea is on a higher ground than the earth at the moment in terms of inclusion. I love all of that. Let's talk for a minute about, I suppose, the really tough reality of what you're seeing in the sea. And we might go from there in terms of, you know, the work that you're doing globally to promote change. You know, you're in the sea all the time. You're seeing the damage that's being done. How is that confronting you?
Yeah, it's I guess it's confronted me so much that I decided to write a book about it. I have a new book out called Ebb and Flow, looking at...
Which is your third book.
It's my third book, yes.
So you're certainly prolific, Iski.
I do love to write about our relationship with water. it seems to be a thing. the previous book, Salt Water and the Blood, touches on a lot of what we've just been talking about around my relationship with surfing and lessons learned there. But yeah, Ebb and Flow, I guess, is looking at my offering of how, of recognizing, yeah, the state of our world's waters and the ocean included. How did we go from, you know, a society in most of the world, many parts of the world, where water was revered, was considered sacred, the source of all life, and it still is the source of all life. We can't live without it. And yet, society today seems hell-bent on the destruction of water and its pollution and degradation. So out of all the environments in the world, water environments are declining the most rapidly, deteriorating the quickest. And that's because water kind of, as I look at it, holds all of who we are. So all the water that there is right now on the planet is all the water that ever was for the last 4 billion years, which is kind of remarkable when we're talking about a sense of connection, interconnection and oneness. Water really is that. So the water in my body now and in your body has, you know, might have moved through a Tyrannosaurus Rex once upon a time. And so we have this real responsibility as I think, for water, both in terms of our own survival, but also what are we passing on? I've kind of found it, rather than it being really a really depressing topic, I think what it shows me is it highlights, again, the importance of those interconnections, of understanding more deeply our relationship with the living world. Water is a wonderful way to reconnect. So Ebb and Flow, the book, is a kind of offering to look at actual practical ways to restore some of those lost connections at a collective and individual level. And then looking at some of like real world examples of that happening, of how we can restore our waters. And then by doing that, how we're actually healing ourselves. So looking at how restorative water can be for us if we look after it.
I mean, the book is 100% on my wish list. I'm going to retrospectively read the others as well. But maybe for our listeners, you might just share some of the takeouts and some of the learnings that people can adopt on an individual level.
Yeah, I think for me, it begins any kind of work around, we're talking about a lot of, I suppose, around restoration or conservation, or when it comes to tackling climate crisis and biodiversity loss. And there's obviously a real sense of urgency there, but we can get caught up, I think, in maybe trying to fix everything and trying to find solutions before actually first feeling that sense of connection. So for me, Ebb and Flow is really about that kind of almost that step zero of how do we, instead of actually rushing into action, how do we first actually pause and reflect and take a moment to think about what water means to us? How are we connected with with nature. Where is our water and what does it do for us? So to begin to reestablish that relationship. So the crisis that we're in, I feel, is really a crisis of relationships. It's a breakdown. It's that sense of separation that we feel between humans and nature, which is, it's we do ourselves no service in holding that story up. So ebb and flow is a way to try to rewrite that story and then actually show practical, creative ways to restore some of those connections. And I wanted to make that as accessible as possible. So there's everything from, you know, spending time just literally sitting with and tuning into your nearest body of water, whatever that might be, and starting to just take a moment to breathe and engage all of your senses and notice water. So it's actually to just be still and do nothing in a way, and the power of that. So that would be the ebb state.
And that was one of the pieces of advice that your father gave you on one of your trips, yeah, was to just indulge in the nothingness of it.
Yeah, yeah. Before, because I don't think we also don't give ourselves enough time to even just like rest and digest or process maybe what just happened. So the importance of that kind of self-reflection before we leap into anything, because that's where I guess the lessons are learned, where we get the new insights and inspiration. It's not from the doing.
We've so little space in our lives. And I think we really are seeing the results of that, of you know, this attention economy that we've created that draws us time and time again. But I wanted to talk to you as a fellow twin mother. I wanted to talk to you. You've already spoken about the, you know, the internal water, the external water, water in all its forms. How much did the process of becoming a mother have to do with your relationship with water?
Everything changed, quite literally. I write a little bit about this in Ebb and Flow as well, but about the, you know, because I wrote a lot of the book during pregnancy, and actually I finished the final manuscript, kind of closed the laptop on it, and then the next day my waters broke.
So oh, now you're just showing off, Easy.
I probably should have maybe taken another week to finish the manuscript, but. But yeah, because my body physically was changing so much, but I feel most, before I was pregnant, I felt most at home in the sea. It's where I could go to sort of reset and feel my own sense of self. I think I write in the book, I'm like, my body is like my ocean going vessel. Like it's where I feel, yeah, where I feel most at home. But then when I was pregnant, all of that changed. My body was changing so dramatically. It felt alien to me. And then in the water, I felt like for the first time in my life, it just felt awkward. Or there's moments where I felt like I just didn't belong.
Your buoyancy was off, basically.
Buoyancy's off, weight is off, center of gravity is off. I felt seasick if it was too choppy. But then there were also incredible moments of, I surfed maybe up until, you know, about halfway through, and then it becomes something then. It's just the biggest barriers are the wetsuits, trying to get in and out of a wetsuit. Impossible. So, and then that defeats the purpose of surfing, which is in order to feel good. But I continue to surf or to swim and kind of just immerse and kind of dip myself regularly in the sea all the way through my pregnancy. And it also offered that amazing, you know, as awkward as I might have felt on land, just that ability to feel held by the water, especially the salt water, to take away that the heaviness in my own body, which was something really special then when you're also carrying and growing life in water, in your body, and to be held then by the water. Yeah, so I kind of find that incredibly calming and helpful throughout my pregnancy and probably why I had such a positive experience. And then also I think it helped when at the time of birth, which was quite challenging, to actually be able to go back to that and revisit the feeling of that in my mind's eye through visualization even. It's another way of connecting with water and how beneficial it can be. So it stays, those experiences stay with us in the body and the body can remember. And so they're great to draw upon whenever we are faced with a challenge and we need to, I suppose, whenever we need to manage that stress response and whenever we have a tendency to maybe when we get triggered or go into that reactive mode, It's something I trained myself to be able to do actually with big wave surfing, to psychologically prepare when, you know, you're confronted with a real sense of fear when a wave's coming crashing down on you, but you cannot panic because it'll use up all your oxygen. You won't be able to hold your breath. So it was really important to actually be able to override that kind of that stress response and remain calm in the face of something like that. So that definitely drew upon that during the birth, which made the big wave surfing like a cakewalk.
And as young as the twins are now, can you see the next generation of sea lovers coming through?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, we're really lucky and fortunate. We're right by the sea. And so I make a point every morning, like, introduce them to the sea, and I describe the conditions and how the waves are and what way the wind is blowing. And but we always go down and like greet the sea. And they just, it's amazing. It is innate in us. I see the effect it has on them straight away. They sleep as soon as we get down onto the beach in the pram. So that kind of contact with the sand and the motion, but also then the sound of the sea, the smell of the sea air. So when it comes with any natural environment, and the more we expose ourselves to it, it's going to have benefits for us, and the younger the better, because they stays with us.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Really,
you know, it's like there is no friction in the acceptance of that calm from the sea at that young age. We build those sort of barriers to letting it in as we grow and as social mores surround us. I'm wondering, though, we talk about progress. You are, it seems to me, in a constant state of both personal evolution. You're very aware of your personal evolution, but also of your professional evolution and your voice and influence on a world stage. And that is really where you find yourself now. What have been the moments where you have felt that you had a major contribution to thinking in this area of conservation, preservation, attitudes to climate and to the ocean? You've seen yourself in some pretty important rooms.
Yes, I always find it kind of, maybe what's the way of just, I'm surprised and grateful. I think it's grateful that in particular, that the ocean is moving into these spaces where, you know, in places like, you know, the European Commission and are having these discussions where it matters most, rather than it being on the fringe. I guess because I'm so immersed in it myself, I maybe don't see it as much like the impact or influence of that so much.
But you're starting a conversation, I suppose, in a lot of quarters. And certainly if you're not starting it, you're driving it forward. And I guess if that's not progress, what is, you know? Even through the books, I think, opening up your philosophy, which is how I started this conversation. It is a very defined philosophy for a way of being with the water on our planet.
Yes, I think that's what it is. And the motivation behind all the books I've written is to be able to, I suppose, try to articulate and give voice to some of that wonder and awe and the healing power of the ocean that I've experienced, and feeling that sense of responsibility then to share a duty of care, to share that with others. And then to learn, you learn so much when you do that. But even the process of writing, it can be quite a vulnerable thing to do and then put it out there. I think it's just really important for me. There's been a lot of growth through that process of writing these books that I feel like I'm growing into now, of finding your voice, of being vulnerable. And it just, I suppose almost that I was thinking about what have I learned from some of the mentors in my life, and one woman in particular who has had perhaps one of the greatest influence outside of my parents would have been the Irish artist Pauline Buick. And from her, I would have known her from when I was 10 years old and went to one of her painting classes all the way until we sadly lost her when she passed away last summer, but still is so influential in my life because what I learned from her, and especially in those early years as a young woman, to just be unashamedly who you are and to boldly give expression to that. And that medium for her, and then that she passed on to me, was through painting, and to, you know, to use color, to be bold, to be expressive. But that, yeah, that unashamed piece is really important, to not carry any shame around who you are and what you do, which I think is especially important for women and in Ireland.
Iski, you are an extraordinary woman, an extraordinary human, and I think one of the purest expressions of humanity that I've come across. You're so in tune with yourself and with your surroundings and your beloved water. It's been an absolute honour. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sonia.